bottle of red, a bottle of white. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant.
Ah, a little Billy Joel to get you in the mood today. And by the way, this is National Ravioli Day. Seems like the perfect day to be talking with our guest about her cookbook. And if you're hungry right now, if you're not, you will be by the end of the interview, because we're talking about Italian-American food today on the show with our guest, Lucinda Scala Quinn. She is the author of 8 cookbooks, including the best-selling Mad Hungry trilogy. And her latest, which we'll talk about today, is Mother Sauce, Italian-American Family Recipes and the Story of the Women Who Created Them. Lucinda was the host of the television show Mad Hungry, Bringing Back the Family Meal, and co-host of Everyday Food on PBS. She began cooking at the age of 16, and I hope you'll join in. Questions for her? Maybe you want to share your favorite Italian-American dish or talk about food with your family. How does the food connect you with your ancestors? We hope you'll call in at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Lucinda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Larry. How are you today?
I'm doing great. You know, I looked at the cover of your book, saw the title, and then I opened it up, and I went to the preface, and the first sentence I read is, I am the proud great-granddaughter of a pistol-packing, beer-swigging, gambling, boss-of-her-block Italian-American contessa who lived in turn-of-the-century East Rome, New York. And I read that and the rest, and I thought, oh, I'm going to love this book. And then I thought, I would really have loved to have known your great-grandmother.
I think you're right. She was one of many fierce, original, pioneering women. She came to America from Calabria in southern Italy, known collectively as the Mezzogiorno, along with Sicily. She left in one of the largest mass migrations in world history. That is the those that left between about 1871 up until about the 1920s. She was just a force of nature. There's so much to say about her. I'm so inspired by her. But, you know, in order to prepare for this book, I read about just dozens and dozens of families. And there were so many Aquilinas out there in the world who really, really, really basically set the tone for the Italian-American foodway, which is, you know, one of our most popular foodways in America. Every child eats pizza or pasta, and every household makes spaghetti.
So what did you learn about yourself and your, maybe your family, too, as a result of the research you did for this book?
That's such a good question. The first thing that I learned, I hearken back to little me. When I was little, we really attended these giant, you know, family multi-generation picnics out of a movie. And I would watch then, as a little girl, I would watch all these women with trays of lasagna. And, you know, we would be on location at like a lake, and the whole family would go, and they'd be bringing trays of lasagna and cannoli and baked ziti and sausage and, you know, cigarettes dangling from their mouth, big bouffant haircuts and hairstyles. And I was always helping them and like amazed by their industry. But then at the same time, I would look over at the great uncles and my grandfather and great grandfather. They'd be sitting there smoking cigars, sipping anisette, laughing, gesticulating, playing bocce. And I thought, ooh, that looks fun too. I kind of like that, but why aren't they helping them? And so I realized, of course, everything we always know about the evolution of culture. But what I really realized was that the women, when they came, you know, they came to this country under extraordinary odds. Yes, the men were building our roadways and our bridges and our tunnels and, you know, working outside the home. But the women, for the most part, couldn't work outside the home. They didn't have the language. They were usually impoverished, had multiple children in cold water flats. And yet they managed to feed their family three times a day. And then very quickly, which I detail in this book to your question, what I learned, there were a lot of single men, certainly in the enclave, Italian enclaves in America, and they would then, these women who had these small places and these big families, after everybody went to bed, they'd set up tables in their living room in order to feed paying guests because Nona's food, Mama's food was so beloved and sought after. And then quickly the men went, wow, we're onto something here. And they began to monetize this food outside the home in the form of underground garages or corner restaurants. These were the beginnings of the what we now know today as trattorias and pizza parlors. And there she was, imagine her in that kitchen, churning out that food and then getting up the next day. And, you know, you had just to have hot water. You had to stoke the fire in the furnace. So these women could never have imagined that 100 years hence, the adopted country that actually shunned them when they arrived, in that country, they would have basically built the foundations for one of the most popular food ways, not just in America, but in the world, because Italian-American food is very different than Italian-Italian food, but chicken parmesan is no less loved in London, England, than it is in Madison, Wisconsin.
In your mind, why are home-cooked meals and family dinners so important to our health and our happiness?
Well, you just struck a nerve that has really been my lifelong work. And interestingly enough, when I wrote this book, I wrote this book about this cuisine and about these people, but it's come out at a time when we can learn so much from these women about how to live today. There is so much, health is at risk so much from preservatives that we eat, processed foods, unhealthy food. Food is so expensive now. So many of us have such a tough time at the grocery store. These are things that these women instinctively knew. They brought their practices from the old country. They learned how to spread meals like, you know, cannellini beans, for instance. You can buy a can, that's affordable. But if you buy a bag and hydrate it, you'll have four times the amount for way less money. You can cook them. You can freeze some. You can make a soup from some. And there are just dozens of ways that these women learned to be frugal, economic. But more importantly, when you got to the table, you were nourished, you were having fun, you were laughing. These are all the ingredients that we need for wellness today. And one last thing on my soapbox is we don't have time to cook. Well, if anyone didn't have time to cook, it was these women, but they certainly did. And we do all have time to cook. And the thing is it's one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself, your family, your friends. And, you know, you mentioned my Mad Hungry series of books. There were three of them. That was about, interestingly enough, I have all brothers and all sons. So those books were about feeding these incredible appetites every single meal. And my agenda wasn't to turn them into foodies. It was really to nourish them, be able to afford to do so, and let them be able to cook for themselves and others. And all three of those young adults, in fact, do that today. And I'm so grateful for that. And I hear from a lot of people that there are other families where that happens too.
Oh, it's Lucinda Scala Quinn, our guest, the author of Mother Sauce, Italian-American Family Recipes and the Story of the Women Who Created Them. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. Tony in Sturgeon Bay has a story for us, I think. Tony, hi.
Yeah, good morning. This is going to be one of your crazier calls. I'm a 100% second-generation Sicilian, and I had two really very powerful grandmothers. And as the story was told to me in the 1930s, and this was my father's mother, Concetta, on Sunday she would open up her doors to anybody who wanted a faith healing and a plate of spaghetti and meatballs. And as my dad told the story, they never knew who was going to be at the dinner table on Sunday, because after dinner, my grandmother would take each person, and it's about faith and food, and she would actually start speaking in very high Latin, which is a Sicilian woman who couldn't read or write. She didn't know anything from Latin, but when she was in this trance-like state, she would be speaking in high Latin, And that was a tradition that none of my father's siblings liked because she would inherit their illness. So she was always ill, but she was always giving, not only of her food, but of herself.
Tony, what a wonderful story. And you also bring up the tradition of Sunday meals, which, you know, is in all of us Italian, Sicilian Americans have, which was after Mass on Sunday. You know, there was a big feast in my family. The men made the wine, the women made the food. And there was always a seat at the table. And that's another thing I write in my book, how you make as much food as you can, and you can always add another chair, period.
Yeah. That is. Tony, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, you've been...
Oh, yeah, can I point out one thing?
Yeah,
so interestingly enough, just because Tony called and he's of Sicilian parentage, there is something on Netflix now that I just discovered called The Leopard, which is a famous novel by Lampedusa. But it was made in Sicily, and it's on Netflix, and it covers the period of time just before our ancestors came to America. And it's fascinating. And to Tony's point about the gift of his you know, grandmother, I think it's a wonderful thing to watch if this is a subject matter that interests you.
And what's the title again?
It's called The Leopard, and it's on Netflix.
Well, I get Netflix, so I'm making a note of that. I'll take a look at it. Lucinda Scala Quinn, our guest today, it's great to have her with us as we talk about her cookbook, Mother Sauce. You've been cooking since you were 16, I think.
Professionally.
You've been doing it for a long time. What do you love about cooking after all these years?
Thank you for mentioning that, because I work all day as a professional cook, and most nights I cook at home, and there's a delineation. And I can honestly say that I am never sick of cooking. There is something very meditative and certain about standing up to the counter with an onion and a clove of garlic and some tomatoes and a thing of pasta, and knowing that in 20 or 30 or 40 minutes, I'm going to have a meal for my family and everybody around me. But also, it's the journey of doing it. I love the smells, I love the flavors, I love going to the market, I love meeting people who are farmers and butchers. It's just a passion. It just got into me as a child at the feet of these incredible women that Tony mentioned. You know, when I was a little girl, I mean, it was insane. And these women were they were so powerful and so passionate. In my family, they used to fight. These women would fight about the meatballs. So on one side of the family, they would fry the meatballs and golden brown and then add tomato sauce to them. And the other side of the family, they would make the tomato sauce, roll the meatballs, and then drop them into the simmering sauce to cook. So this is the passion of the Italian-American family. And, of course, I cook food from all over the world now, or just even, any food. But getting back to your question about health, I just think that the minute you're cooking fresh food at home and seasoning it well with salt and pepper, you're already, you know, miles ahead of where you would be if you were constantly feeding yourself processed food. Health-wise.
Lucinda Scala Quinn, our guest. I'm Larry Mehler. You're listening to Talk at WPR.org and The Larry Mehler Show. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mehler here as we talk with Lucinda Scala Quinn, who is the author of Mother Sauce, Italian-American Family Recipes and the Story of the Women Who Created Them. You can join in, numbers 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's talk about the book, Mother Sauce. I really like it. Why should someone pick it up and try out a few recipes?
Well, I told you, and I think you'd agree, that if you look around any corner of our country, Italian-American food is some of our most popular food. So we're talking about the story behind these recipes, but this book is anchored in 100 iconic recipes that we all have come to know and love. Tomato pie, which is like an at-home pizza, you know, spaghetti and meatballs, chicken parmesan, tiramisu, the Italian cookie tray, which is a tradition, our ancestors brought to this country so many of the vegetables we take for granted today that we love: artichokes, broccoli rabe, escarole. You know, these are all things that they brought with them and that they popularized. So you can be sure that if you have if you have this book on your shelf and you have a hankering for, I don't know, like a Sunday sauce for your Sunday dinner, it's going to be in there. And because I've been a recipe developer for 40 years, you can be sure that there's no extra ingredients, that it's clearly written. And I've gotten feedback already from so many people that it's just easy to make the food in this book with the, you know, simplest ingredients, easy recipes, and the highest expression of flavor. And that's the goal of anybody who does this for a living. And I'm confident that you'd find that in this book. Now, if you start reading, like you said, that first sentence, there is a lot to read about the history and also about where things came from, the origin of names. Every single part of this country has regional specialties, has things that's the difference between Italian American food and Italian food, where like cooking, you know, food in Rome or Florence is very specific and there's a way to do it. Well, our ancestors came to America from different regions, whether it was Campania, Calabria, Abruzzo. It wasn't until they got to America that they were Italians generically. And then our food became a whole nother thing because we came to America with technique and no resources, but we found in America, not where the streets were paved in gold, but where our oceans and our forests and our lakes were abundant in the riches that changed the way these people cooked. Also, suddenly you were on the dawn of, you know, frozen food, the bird's eyes, you know, canned foods, ground meat. And this is where the two things met: the techniques that came from the old country, the produce from the new country. And suddenly you have the birth of this food way, Italian American food, one of the most popular. And the other thing is that this is a wonderful Mother's Day gift, because you'll see yourself, whether it's Polish American, Korean American, Mexican American, everybody loves Italian food. And you'll be reading about the stories that will feel like your family, and pair it with a, you know, bottle of olive oil, pound of spaghetti. And it's a really beautiful, beautiful gift. And this, I've been told too, like, I have the heirloom recipes from my grandmother, you know, handwritten cards. I think this book is going to turn into a little bit of a cherished heirloom, because these things aren't going to change. People are still going to want to eat this food, no matter, you know, and generations on are still going to be making their versions of this food.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking back to your comments about how the mothers and the grandmothers brought these recipes and cooked them, and then the fathers and the grandfathers
monetized them,
and I don't think the women got a whole lot of attention.
No, but what they did get, and what I've learned, and this is a story over and over and over again, is that stove in the kitchen was their main creative power center, where they could express themselves, and the audience was their dinner table. And so that's why they were so gifted. And they had no choice, by the way. They didn't just suddenly decide to become like a new hipster chef or something like we see, you know, now. They had no choice. And yet they managed to persevere, make their own special sauce. And it was incredible pride. They banded together the women so that they didn't have to do all these chores themselves, whether it was in a building and your neighbors all helped, or extended family and your aunts and your uncle and your aunts helped. Nowadays, and let's be fair, like, many women are working full time. Many men are the chefs, and they're continuing traditions. Fortunately, we're in a more equitable society, but the circumstances under which this food was built, let's make no mistake, it was monetized. And you look around and you see, what do you see? You see Patsy's and Gino's and Rao's. You don't see the names of women all over these big chains, because they were not in the forefront at that time. Fortunately, now we have a lot of wonderful cooks that we see on TV, that we read about. My book is concerned with the women that built the food way, ostracized at the time from their adopted country, who nonetheless managed to create the most delicious food, and that is still prized and loved and cooked today.
And as you call it, the cooking style of the poor, I think is a term that you use.
Yes, it's called cucina povera, and it came from Italy, and every region of Italy had it. It was where it was the poorest of the poor, where they were frequently taking leftovers. For instance, there would be a full animal butchery. Nobody would go to the store and buy like 10 chicken breasts. There would be full animal butchery, and that's where the whole tradition of salumis came about. And if you go to any deli nowadays or any market, forget about salami and pepperoni. There's sofrasata. There's a million different things. And this is all a frugal way to handle the produce that they had. And so they're so gifted. I mean, chestnuts grew abundantly. So the poor would dry chestnuts, grind it into flour, make pastas out of chestnuts. Breadcrumbs, rehydrated, reused, were made into different kinds of noodles. Again, tomatoes, you had this dry southern landscape. So tomatoes and peppers and citrus all grew abundantly. They learned how to be able to use them fresh and repurpose them for the winter. So incredibly resourceful, so smart, and again, relevant and delicious today.
And you talk about frugal ways to cook in your kitchen, and you give a lot of tips. Some of them I found really good. Do you want to talk about some of those ways?
Sure. I mean, I just did one this morning. So when it's not just me, but all of us stand up, you know, make food, whatever. We're chopping, we're peeling a carrot, we're chopping an onion, we're taking the stringy part off a celery, and then we discard that but I don't discard that. Anything, whether it's an onion peel, a stalk from celery, you name it, I stick it in a reusable container that's in the freezer. And then once a week, I add water, a little salt, I simmer it, strain it, and then I have a quart of vegetable stock. Now that vegetable stock will stand in for any recipe that calls for chicken stock or any liquid that you need for a soup or for a recipe. That's just one thing. How to buy, for instance, chickens, a whole chicken, where you can then use the wingtips and the backbone in order to make a broth. You can use the breasts for one meal. You can use the legs and the thighs for another. It's cheaper, less people have touched your product, and you're making two or three more meals than you would if you were buying a premium meat. So these kinds of ideas are repeated over and over and over again. If you know, Parmesan cheese, Romano cheese, those are very expensive things right now, but you can take breadcrumbs, bread that's dried out, grind it up, toss it in a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, some anchovies if you want, toast them, and then put that salty, crispy, crunchy on top of your pasta dish. That's just, as satisfying as cheese and a heck of a lot less expensive.
A whole lot cheaper. And you do talk about flavor there. And you had one little tip about salt that I'd forgotten. I think I'd been told it once, but I'd forgotten that it had to do with salting meat.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the thing is when, if you're trying to get a sear on meat, you want it to come to room temperature. So that's called tempering. And so let's just say we were making chicken marsala. I would get the chicken from the fridge 20 to 30 minutes ahead of time. I would pat it dry to get it dry. And then the minute you put that salt on, if you leave it too long, it's going to bead up and it's going to then be wet again. So how are you going to get the sear? So what I do is I get everything ready, and right before I put it in the pan, then I season it. And so the salt and the meat hits the pan and it is able to sear and get that color you might want. Now, there are techniques called early salting, but that's a whole nother thing, and that I'm not concerning myself with that in this. So I thought you were also going to say about cooking pasta with the salt. So when you cook your pasta, you boil your water. I always wait and salt right before I put the noodles in, because A, sometimes I can't remember if I salted or not, and B, sometimes I'm cooking with a bunch of other people. But when you salt that water for pasta, you make it salty like the sea. So you don't put a little tiny bit or a teaspoon. You put a nice handful of salt in there, because that's what the noodles are going to absorb and create flavor. And that's something really important that people don't really realize when they're making spaghetti or penne or rigatoni or anything.
I flash back to I used to make a tomato, sort of a V8 tomato juice, and I liked it a lot. And one of my students, I gave her some, and she said, "Oh, I like this. I got to make it. Give me the recipe." And so she comes in the next, about a week later, and she said, "Oh, the recipe just didn't turn out." And I said, "What happened?" She said, "It was so salty." And And I said, well, it shouldn't have been. Were you making this with somebody? And she said, I was making it with my mother. And it turned out she went back and the mother had put the salt in and she had also put the salt in.
Yeah. And so often making spaghetti dinners or pasta meals, you're with a family and you never know. And some people put oil in there. You don't put oil in the boiling water. That is the biggest no-no. You do not do that. There's so many basic little tips in this book. If you are not a cook and you want to learn to cook, you can learn to cook from this book. So that makes it also a wonderful gift. And because in the front of the book, I talk about ingredients, how to shop, how to do it. What do you need in your kitchen? Spoiler alert, not much. This is not, you know, fancy ingredients, fancy cookware. Nope. And you will be surprised. You just, I always say about a book, find one thing that you are interested in, make it. And if you love that recipe, make it again and make it again. And then it becomes yours. And not, that is so true in Italian-American recipes and cooking. You know, here we have, as I said, 100 iconic recipes. So if you like Italian-American food, or you go to the pizza local pizza parlor, or you go to the local trattoria, or your favorite Italian-American restaurant, chances are that recipe is going to be in this book and you can do it yourself at home.
Yeah. I was I love the fact that you're not afraid of canned tomatoes, for example, or other canned products.
Well,
actually, this time of year, canned tomatoes taste much better than the...
I am always a proponent of canned or frozen out of season. Out-of-season frozen blueberries are 8 zillion times better than whatever you're getting fresh. It's also, you know, I want to tell you a funny story about canned. So everybody knows the Chef Boyardee canned raviolis. I mean, they were wild. They were put in the mess kits of our soldiers. But that was an Italian American who happened to come to America and intersect with the advent of the canning industry, which is the early part of the last century. His name was Edward Boyardee. And when he first made this canned ravioli, people were like, no one can understand your name. And somebody, a marketer, recommended that they call him Chef Boyardee. So that's one of the Italian American stories. Same with if you go to the store and you buy broccoli rabe in the market, you'll see a little tag usually that says Andy Boy. That is run by a fifth generation Italian American, Sicilian American, who brought those seeds straight from Sicily, the wild greens that, again, the ancestors used to eat, that they used to collect on the roadside, that after a long, hard winter, they would be able to nourish themselves with. So all this stuff was intuitive to them. And nowadays, we can look at them, and we, as I said in the beginning of the show, we can learn from them not only about nutrition and wellness and happiness, but, you know, about frugality and how to cook for yourself in an affordable way that is very satisfying.
You know, you do talk about many ingredients, olive oil, tomatoes, and noodles that claim to be authentic. Is there something that's worth splurging for?
Yes. It's always worth, well, you know, again, and even the splurge you can find a way to afford. For instance, extra virgin olive oil, which I use on everything. If you go to, you know, a lot of places where these turn over, they'll be in larger quantities and they'll be more affordable. And then you just have like a cruet next to your, you know, on your counter and refill it. And then keep that larger container in a dark place in a cupboard. And it's going to be infinitely more affordable than getting a tiny bottle of overpriced olive oil that you use up too fast. So I would personally splurge on olive oil. You make a really interesting point about canned tomatoes. I recommend 2 canned tomatoes in my book. And everybody says San Marzano, which are the DOP tomatoes from Italy. But the thing is that the most important thing is to find a tomato, a canned tomato. Don't just wantonly throw it in. Taste it. Is it sweet? Is it tangy? Is it salty? If it's a little bit too tangy, you can add a little bit of sugar to offset it. But then you find out what is pleasing to you, and you use those. There's a lot of trickery in marketing where there'll be these, like, you know, labels that look like some, you know, pastoral Italy gone by from 100 years ago. And it's really just a clever marketing tool with really inferior tomatoes inside. And price doesn't necessarily identify it. You know, I'm always trying new ones. If I see that there's a special, that doesn't turn me away at the market. Like, I will maybe try a brand that I've never had and I'll discover something new. but you don't want out of season tomatoes. Canned tomatoes are a must in the Italian American kitchen. I keep them in there all the time. Also, I don't buy pureed or crushed. I buy whole tomatoes because why? Sometimes we need whole tomatoes. If we need pureed, we can pureed them with a blender or with a, you know, with our, we can crush them with our hands. We could take scissors in there and cut them up. Again, you start with a whole ingredient is usually less expensive. You have more control over it. And so you don't have to see something in your, you know, a recipe and then go, oh dear, I don't have crushed tomatoes. I can't cook. But you have canned tomatoes with like whole tomatoes. You just cut them up. So again, the beginning of this book is filled with all kinds of tips like that.
Let's talk about some of the recipes. And by the way, I have a scissors that I have often gone and scissored into the can to do just what.
Oh, that's a great thing to do. Most people don't realize what an easy thing that is to do.
Let's go to recipes and talk about some of them in your book. The green minestrone.
Oh, yeah.
This was inspired by your grandmother, I think.
And, yes, it was.
And we're going to have it up on our website, too. We're going to put that.
Yeah, it's so funny you should mention that, because a friend of mine who's a book editor, she just wrote me last night. She said, oh, I love your book. And by the way, the first thing I made was the green minestrone. Now, this recipe was literally in that loopy old handwriting from my grandmother. And the reason she made this recipe is because it's what was in her garden. Now, we think of minestrone at the root of minestrone really means soup. But we think of minestrone, we think of that like magenta red stuff that comes in a can or we get at the diner. But that's not my favorite kind of minestrone. Now, in this one, it's delicious, but it uses, again, frugal ingredients. You've got green beans and garlic and onion and cabbage and potatoes, but you have some Parmesan cheese and some chickpeas and green peas. So it's the perfect recipe for this time of year because some of these things are starting to come out into the market. And then what makes this different is you make a little pesto and then you drizzle it on top of the soup. So you've got this like two layers of flavor. You know, you've got the greens and the vegetables and the broth, but you have this pesto that has this powerful flavor from the pine nuts or almonds, along with basil and olive oil and a little bit of garlic and cheese. So that is a beautiful recipe for this time of year. In fact, maybe I'll make it for dinner tonight.
Well, it looks pretty easy to put together, I think. And again, I'll just mention that's one. We have two recipes that we'll have up on our page today, talk at wpr.org/Larry. And one of them is this green minestrone, which I really, I'm going to be trying it for sure. And another one I will try is the mini meatball sandwiches.
Oh,
and
man.
These are, you say in your book, these are family favorites and often served at holiday parties.
Yeah, in fact, we had a big launch in New York City and Brooklyn for this book, and I made dozens and dozens of those, and I froze them, I cooked them and froze them, and then just put them on a baking sheet right before we ate. When I was a little girl, my mother used to make bags of them and put them in the freezer, and at the holidays, she'd heat them up and put them out, and we would eat them. They're tiny. They're, maybe 1 inch square, and this is something that is absolutely particular to my family. I've never seen this anywhere else. It's in this book. I've made this recipe for years. I've demoed it on the Today Show. Any chance I get, because no one's ever really seen it, which is basically, and the key to this, which is, again, talk about evolution, is you've got your meatball meat, but it's that Pepperidge Farm extra thin bread that you make it on and cut it in quarters and bake it. I also have a little trick because I cut the edges off when I make them in quarters. And then the edges, the crusts, which have a little bit of meat sticking to them, I cook those on the side. And then that's what I eat while I'm cooking. That's the cook's treat. But the meatball sandwiches are, once you eat those and you know you can freeze them, and that's a favorite. People love that recipe.
Bob in Kewaunee has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Well, good morning. When I think of Italian food, I'm thinking pastas, pizzas, and stuff like that. But prior to coming to America, there were no tomatoes in Italy. What was the basis of their cooking and their sauces?
Well, there were Bob. I mean, in southern Italy, the Bourbons who were ruling before unification, there was tomatoes in Italy. There most certainly was before they came. The migration happened post 1870. Before these women even came, they were drying tomatoes. They were turning them into paste. They were drying the paste. They were making them into bricks. When you're talking about no tomatoes, you're probably talking, 300, 400, 500 years ago. But the people that came to America from the Mezzogiorno, they had tomatoes. Now, they didn't necessarily have like tons of tomatoes. As I said, they learned how to turn them into more of a tomato paste. That's the origin of the tomato paste that we have today.
Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. John emailed us. He wonders if he wonders if there's a recipe for tomato sauce in the book and why homemade sauce is better than opening a jar of Prego.
Well, thank you. Is it Johnny? Because that's a wonderful question. There are not only there's a my there's my basic go-to tomato sauce, which is like four ingredients, and spoiler alert, I don't use onions in that. And there's meat, there's bolognese, there's a meat sauce, there's a meat sauce with sausage, there's one with meatballs. The problem when you open a jar off the shelf is that there's stabilizer in there so that it can sit on the shelf. And when you're talking about tomatoes and garlic, and I know because in my job, I mean, I was the food director for Martha Stewart for 15 years, and I learned a lot about how to, making food, to package. And it's very difficult to get that fresh flavor through when you have to put stabilizers in this food to make it shelf stable. And the thing that blows my mind, you still have to boil water and make the noodles, right? So in that period of time, with a can of tomato, garlic, and olive oil and salt, you can make sauce. It's going to be less expensive. It's going to be way more delicious, as Johnny points out. And this is some of the practices that we've got away from in sort of big industry food America.
Bess in Green Bay emailed us. Their family has a Bohemian German Polish ancestry. One of their favorite family recipes is Mama Stiletti's spaghetti sauce with meatballs. The recipe now is two big cans of tomato paste diluted with seven cans of water. The seasoning is only in the meatballs, and it is in the simmering over hours to boil down the sauce that flavors it. My brothers and I would test the meatballs as they simmered, and quickly mom realized that she needed to add another pound of meat in order to have any left for dinner. It was still one of her strongest memories and best comfort foods.
Oh, Bess is really hitting on something that all of us Italian Americans remember, the pot simmering on the stove, the meatballs there. And that's why I say that if your meatball, and getting back to the prior question, the meatballs are going to flavor the sauce. Now, she points out tomato paste and water. That was so common for an immigrant. So that could have been her great grandmother, whatever, because they knew how to boil down the tomatoes, make the paste, and then rehydrate the paste in order to make the sauce. And I'll bet you that when she walks into a kitchen and smells anything like that, it immediately transports you right back to being in that kitchen. So when you're making meatballs and sauce, you don't need to make a whole fancy sauce and the meatballs. Just make the meatballs and add the tomatoes, and the meatballs flavor the sauce. That's what you see in my book.
Our guest today, Lucinda Scala Quinn. Her book is Mother Sauce: Italian American Family Recipes and the Story of the Women Who Created Them. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Lucinda Scala Quinn, author of Mother Sauce: Italian American Family Recipes and the Story of the Women Who Created Them. Wonderful cookbook, filled with a lot of great, interesting history, as well as the recipes that she has in her book. They're wonderful. I was thinking, I had a girlfriend many a moon ago. Her name was Irene. She was from New York City, and her mother was a full Italian. And Irene would make for me eggplant parmesan, which was quite a process. I mean, there were stacked eggplants that had been salted and a heavy plate put on top of the stack and so forth. And I never got that recipe quite right after we parted ways. I tried many times. So I was excited, in a way, to see your eggplant Romano Carolina recipe in your book. It's not anything like Renee's, but it's another way to, I think, kind of make an eggplant Parmesan type dish.
Yeah, Larry, you noted, well, I have in my former books two other eggplant Parmesan recipes, one of which does the laborious thing that you mentioned, which is salting and breading and frying and layering, and another one that grills the eggplant pieces before you stack them into the Parmesan. This was a result of something that one of my grandmothers used to do. And what she did was layer the eggplant fry it and layer it into the same pan. And in between the layers, she would put the breadcrumbs with the Parmesan and the herbs and some cheese, and then bake that right in the oven. So it's sort of like making a pie of eggplant Parmesan, or in this case, I use Romano and I call it Carolina because I have a great aunt who, she was a wonderful cook. And my niece, the next generation, who is in her early 20s, when I was developing this book, she ate it and went crazy for it. So I then sent her the recipe and she makes it all the time. A note about eggplant. It used to be that we had to salt and wait for eggplant to sweat to get the bitterness out of the eggplant. That's just not really necessary most of the time. Now, if you're going to buy a really old eggplant that's been sitting on the supermarket shelf and you have no idea how long it's been, that is necessary because it can become embittered. But most of the market fresh, if you buy eggplant at a farmer's market or you grow eggplant, most of this has been bred out and you do not need to do that. And if you are going to salt, 5 minutes isn't going to do anything for you. You have to do at least 30 minutes up to a couple hours. I have a whole section on it in this book. I did a bunch of tests. And I'm a huge fan of eggplant. I love eggplant. I think it's just such a nice, palate for absorbing flavors. And in fact, it was this dish that preceded chicken Parmesan, veal Parmesan, because when the Italians came to America, suddenly meat was way more plentiful so that they would adapt different techniques to meats, which is, again, to think that they could eat veal with such abandon, that's why you see veal all over the place. But nowadays, people aren't eating veal. I even use turkey in one of the dishes, turkey piccata, instead of veal, because that's more of what people are making now.
Yeah. And that recipe, Eggplant Romano Carolina, is the other recipe that will be available on our website for you to try out. Just go to talk@wpr.org/Larry and go to today's date. WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date and you'll find those links to those recipes in our comments section. So I'm definitely going to try that one out. Now, I'll be thinking of my old girlfriend, Irene, when I do it. I think she's living in California now. So anyway.
Maybe she'll buy my book and find some nostalgia in the stories.
I hope so. Well, here we are. We've got Easter coming.
Oh, yeah.
And you work with your brother Jim for one of the recipes, Brother Jim's Easter lamb.
That is a spectacular recipe. Well, lamb was on the table. It was a feasting, again, it was a sign of spring. Lamb would have been on the table for the Easter feast. So much of it would have been cooked to bits. But now this is an example of kind of a modernized recipe where the flavors are there. But what my brother did was take a butterfly leg of lamb, which you can buy butterfly, or you can do it yourself and then save the bone and use the bone. And you can use that for a soup or a broth or whatever. But it basically is you are marinating with a ton of fresh herbs and a little bit of vinegar and olive oil and garlic. And because of the way a butterfly leg of lamb meat is, it's very easy to cook it quickly. And it's got kind of crevices, so you'll have some well done and some a little more rare. And it's a beautiful recipe for the grill. And it pairs beautifully with steamed asparagus, which is another spring food. And then we have Italian fries in here, which is one of the most spectacular, again, I credit my mom. It's one of the most spectacular ways to eat potatoes that you will ever eat in your life. It's so delicious. It's not fried in terms of in oil. It's all made on a sheet pan. And once you make it, you'll never go back. It's so delicious.
an Easter dessert. With a back to Irene for just a second, she used ricotta in a lot of things. I love ricotta. And
me too.
And the Easter dessert, you have a ricotta pie, which I am definitely going to make, and probably for Easter.
One of my favorite cooks here in New York, who's very well known, she picked that out, and she's going to make that. This is the genesis of a very, very important tradition in Italian cooking, and it uses, the wheat berries inside of it herald the beginning of spring. And by the way, you may not know this, Larry, but there's a ricotta recipe in this book too, because it's the easiest cheese to make at home. It's literally two ingredients, cream or milk and lemon. And it takes no time to make. And I like to put that on the table instead of butter sometimes with some black pepper just to slather onto bread with a little bit of olive oil. But I'll do that. You can buy beautiful ricotta anywhere, but it is so simple to make. And it's so delicious and so fresh and so healthful. And one of the things that Nona and Mama, they made it at home. They didn't necessarily buy it. There's also an Easter spinach pie in here that is, I'm actually making that tonight for something else, but that is just a beautiful pie for a brunch. You can also make them individual hand pies. You can also add ham. And which I do, I put cubed ham into the spinach pie. But if you don't want to and you want to make it vegetarian, you can do that too.
Wow, I am so hungry right now.
Me too.
What? How's the book doing, by the way?
Well, it's tough to know. We just launched last week.
Yeah.
We had a big event. I've been doing nonstop media. I went to the Tucson Book Festival last weekend, which was spectacular. I'm heading to Washington, D.C. Next week. And I'm going across the country just talking about the book because I'm very proud of it. These days, you can just Google a recipe. So when you make a cookbook, you really have to make it an experience. And so from the lush photographs to the history, I have a page in the back which has all of the continuously operating Italian-American markets in the U.S., which covers the whole country. And a reading list of a lot of the stuff that I read to kind of educate myself in there too. So I hope that people get to see this book and that it cuts through. And I think it's a fabulous Mother's Day gift. And one last thing is it's Women's History Month. So I'm very happy to be launching it at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned photos, and shame on me for not mentioning them earlier, because there are wonderful photos and they make you want to try.
I really put a lot of energy into putting a team together to make it look as delicious as I know it tastes. So thank you for noticing that.
Oh, so what's next for you?
Next for me is I'm focusing right now, I have a business called Mad Hungry, which makes kitchen tools. And so I'm constantly, running around dealing that. I'm going on QVC with my new kitchen tools on Sunday. I'm going to DC on the 27th. Between May 6th and May 10th, I'll be in Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. And that's as far as I'm looking ahead right now, Larry.
Well, what a pleasure this has been to talk with you, Lucinda, and also to have a copy of your book. I thank you so much for being with us today. You've put together a wonderful book, cookbook, and I hope a lot of people buy it.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Lucinda Scala Quinn, and her book is titled Mother Sauce, Italian-American Family Recipes and the Story of the Women Who Created Them. It's great to have her with us, and I hope you do get a chance to take a look at the book. And for a taste of it, go to our site today, talk@wpr.org/Larry, and the two recipes that we talked about, two of the recipes we talked about, are on our page. And coming up, we'll travel to Italy next and talk with a wonderful guy who's a travel writer, teacher, and guide, Glenn Schmidt. That's next. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News.
cantare.
Oh man, you hear Dean Martin and singing that Volare, and it takes you right to Italy.
I love the music and I love the food.
That voice you just heard was Glenn Schmidt. Glenn back with us. He is in the studio. He's a travel writer, a teacher, a guide, a storyteller. And he wrote the book that you can get your hands on. It's titled Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel. And and you're actually headed to Italy next month. You've been there many times.
I was there in November. I was there in October. I'll be there again in April.
So, back and forth he goes.
I find Italy an absolutely delightful destination, and with so many different places to go are different from each other.
Yeah. And your book, Travel Lessons, by the way, is not just about Italy.
I looked at it. There's a surprising amount about Italy in there, simply because I like Italy a lot. But the travel lessons part is I'm trying to teach you something along the way. I was a classroom teacher for 32 years, so I know how to make a lesson plan, Larry.
Well, as we talk with you, Glenn, I want to invite our listeners to join in. And as you're listening, maybe you can tell us about the time you went to Italy, or maybe an experience to share about a trip or trips that you've taken there, or maybe just a question that you have about travel, or maybe just kind of the mechanics of it are something that Glenn knows a whole lot about. But what made that trip to Italy memorable. Let me get that right. Memorable for you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. You mentioned that Italy, there's, depending on where you are in Italy, you're going to have a different kind of experience. What should you consider when you go to Italy?
Fair question. First, let me tell you what happened this morning. I checked my email, and a friend contacted me who I haven't talked to since last summer, and he said, "Glenn, I'm planning a trip to Italy. Can you help me out here?" And I said, "Well, tune into the Larry Mueller show at noon today." But, you know, Larry, that's pretty much the advice I give my friends anyway. And it's just general life advice to tune into the Larry Mueller show.
Well, I love it. I hope he calls in. Maybe he can ask you a question right on the air. I love that.
Lewis, if you're out there, you had a good question. Give me a call.
800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org.
Larry, can I talk a little about the trip that's coming?
Yeah, I'd love to hear about it.
Lake Maggiore is a place I haven't been to. It's up in the northern part of Italy, right next to Lake Como. These are some lakes that basically come down from Switzerland. And so it's up in the mountains. And we're flying into Milan, which is about an hour from Stresa, which is right on the lake. We're renting a 7-bedroom villa overlooking Lake Maggiore. And we're going to spend a week there. The villa costs about $8,000, but there's 11 of us on this trip. So you think about it, it's about $100 a night that it's costing us. And so if you add in the airfare, which for us was about $1,200, for $2,000, you get a week-long vacation in one of the prettiest parts of Italy.
Yeah, it's. You can spend $2,000 on a week in Disney. In Florida,
if you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky. Well, 11 people couldn't do it for two.
No.
Anyway, at all. Well, so that sounds like fun. What are the other different areas of the country, and how does somebody decide, you know, which area to visit?
The first thing I would do is go out and buy a good guidebook. I was in Venice in November, and Venice is one of my favorite places. First time I went there, I didn't think I was going to enjoy Venice. I thought it was kind of a stage set. I was wrong. I really fell in love with Venice, and it's good any time of year. But we were there in November, and A strange thing happened to me in the hotel. So we're in a hotel just off the Grand Canal in Venice, and we're having breakfast. And there's a guy at the next table. We had seen him for a couple mornings before, and he was down there before the rest of his family. And so he's listening to our conversation, and finally he interrupts us and says, "Hey, are you a travel writer?" And I said, "Well, I must be. I've written a travel book." And he said, "My wife's a travel writer." And I said, "Really? What does she do?" "Well, she writes for Arthur Frommer, the guidebook. She helps write the Guide to Italy, which I had sitting up in my room." And so he was really kind of funny about it, because he said, "Well, what's the name of your book?" And I said, "Travel Lessons." And he immediately went on Amazon and he bought it, just like that. It was the easiest book sale I've made.
That is cool. Well, as long as we're on Venice, most people think of the canals and the gondola rides. Excuse me. How accurate is that, the idea of Venice?
You know, you're going to think of that. We took a friend with us on this November trip who hadn't been there before, and that was really high on our list to go on a gondola ride. But when we got there, it kind of faded out. It's an expensive ride. It's, you know, it looks really romantic, but we're there in November. Everybody's all bundled up. The Grand Canal is a busy highway, and it is full of traffic. I mean, it's the only way in and out. You're not going to have trucks or cars or anything. So you've got what they call vaporettos. And what I recommend is, when you get into Venice, you'll come into the main train station. And I don't care how you get there, you're coming in to the main train station. And then what you should probably do is buy at least a three-day vaporetto pass. I paid $45 for one for 3 days. And that's essentially the water bus. And it will take you anywhere on the Grand Canal in Venice, and it'll take you to any place in Venice that's worth going to. Venice is a city where you get lost, but you have to remember you're basically on an island, so it doesn't matter where you go, you're not getting off that island. So you'll end up in the main square.
You'll end up in the main square. And so what should we see when we go there?
You know, there's a whole variety of things. It's because it's Italy, there are all sorts of things that are based on the Catholic Church, and the museums and everything else have that in mind. But Venice is the first thing you have to remember is you're going to have to pay a tourist tax. Now, they're about the only place in Italy so far. Lake Como's thinking of doing it, but right now Venice is the only place. A tourist tax, it's €5 if you pay it online ahead of time. It's €10 if you wait till you get to the city to do it. So you can go to the best museum. My favorite museum is the Peggy Guggenheim Museum. Now, Peggy Guggenheim was kind of the black sheep of the Guggenheim family. And you know, you think Guggenheim, you think high art. Well, it turns out that she befriended back in the 20s all of these artists like Picasso and George Braque and all of these people, and she purchased their art. And so now her house has been turned into a museum, and you can see Jackson Pollock. She was an early supporter of him. You can walk through the museum and see all of these wonderful works of art, totally in context.
Oh, it sounds wonderful to me. Talking travel to Italy today, and again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Well, we should talk about food a little. We just had a wonderful interview with an author about Italian American cooking, but food for you, what's
about 5 years ago, we went on, let's call it a roots tour, with a friend of mine who his wife wanted to find her roots in Sicily, and my friend, her husband Steve, said we are going to eat our way through Italy. Steve's kind of a gourmet. and I have never eaten better in my life. After the first day, I let Steve do the ordering. But, you know, the cannelloni, the gnocchi, the pizza, tiramisu, the seafood. Do not underestimate the seafood in Italy. Did you talk about that with the previous guests, the seafood?
We didn't get to much on seafood. But she has quite a nice chapter on seafood. But
okay. We went to a restaurant in Sorrento, and it was a beautiful restaurant. It was like being in a terrarium. We had gotten a tip ahead of time that petsonia was the fish of choice to have. And so we get there, and we're about to order, and it's not on the menu. And my friend Steve says to the waiter, who was kind of standoffish, Steve says, "Well, what about the petsonia? We really came for that." And all of a sudden, Steve is now the waiter's best friend. And pretty soon, the waiter is bringing out all of these fish to the table with their heads still on. And we're looking at the fish, and the fish are looking back at us. And we finally ended up having some petsonia, which was the local delicacy.
Oh, a great story. And in terms of cost on food, is it, you know, I suppose it depends, like any place. I mean, like the U.S. or Wisconsin, you know, you can go to a McDonald's type, or you can go to L'Etoile in Madison.
My experience is it's fairly comparable to eating here. I generally did not go to the Michelin-starred restaurant, so I can't speak for those. And as far as street food there, you're more likely to find like cannelloni, or really gelato is a national religion. And finding the best gelato place in any given town is often a mission that people take upon themselves.
Our guest today, Glenn Schmidt, travel writer, teacher, guide, and storyteller. The book he's authored is Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel. Questions for him or maybe an experience to share, give a call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking about travel to Italy with our guest today, Glenn Schmidt, travel writer, author of Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel. Questions, comments, experience to share, again, the number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call, Max in Madison. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for having me. I've been to Venice twice, most recently was this October, and it's just a great city. It's probably one of my favorites in the entire world. One of the things I'd recommend is just walking around. Don't even look at a map, just start walking left and right, and you'll cross canals and see some really cool stuff.
Yeah, Max, thanks for calling. What do you think, Glenn?
That is absolutely good advice. That is the best way to see it. There are a few places you might point toward, though. Glass blowing is a really huge thing in Venice. It's on a separate island from Venice. You have to go out to Murano to see it, and the Vaporetto will get you out there. But there's one other thing, and we went to it in November. There is it's almost a World's Fair kind of a thing for art. Mm. It's called the Biennale, and it's been going for 60 years.
Wow.
It starts in June, it'll end in November, and it has pavilions for different countries based on a particular theme that they have for art. So it is a very big deal over there.
Interesting. Marcia had emailed us. Marcia and her husband celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary in 2005. They chose Italy and visiting Venice, Genoa, and Terra?
Cinque Terre, yeah.
Cinque Terre, is that how it's pronounced? Sorry. Yeah. Marcia's husband surprised her with a past, present, and future diamond ring from a local jeweler while they were sitting in St. Mark's Square listening to the dueling orchestras. Very romantic, and what a wonderful setting.
It doesn't get more romantic than that, does it? The dueling orchestras, I loved that. At night, there's on one side of the square, and it's a huge square,
And where is it? Is it
this in... is yeah in St. Mark's Square in Venice.
Oh, okay.
And there'll be like a violin quartet or something. And if you move to the other side of the square, there's a competing one. But you get right in the middle, and you're kind of hearing both of them at the same time. But it's thanks for that memory because that brought that back.
Thanks, Marcia. Gianni in Montello will go to you. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good afternoon. Hey, I've never been to Italy for obvious reasons, but I'm wondering how your guest perceives the potential for the EU, and how will that play in the minds of the Italians and their thoughts about Americans?
So a question about the tariffs and perceptions and what about the exchange rate as well?
Thank you. I was going to bring that up. I'm not sure where the tariffs will end up playing into this, but I am more concerned about the exchange rate. When I was there in November, the exchange rate was $1.03 would get you a euro. And now the U.S. dollar, just in the past week, internationally has fallen 2.5%. It has fallen 6% against the euro since the beginning of the year. So essentially, the confidence in the dollar has eroded, and it is going to cost you 6% more to go to Italy this year than it would have last year. So that is something definitely to keep an eye on.
And your last visit, in terms of relations with the people that you met, the local people that you met?
You know, I was in Costa Rica last week. And, Larry, every person I met seemed to be Canadian. And you know what? I don't believe them. I think they're Americans masquerading as Canadians. And I could be wrong about that. I didn't want to test them too far and, you know, ask them where, Ontario was. I don't know.
So it's going to be about 6% more.
Yeah, than it was a year ago, or than it was even in November.
How many Italians? Here's another email. How many Italians speak English, and should you make an effort to learn Italian?
Let me just back up one second. There's another thing that, and we talked about this last time, Larry. It's called ETIAS. It's this non-visa visa that Europe is going to require even Americans to pay for.
Okay.
And when I talked to you last, they had announced they were going to implement it in May. They have since rolled that back to December of 2026. So I'm not sure if that's coming anytime soon. So as far as learning Italian, I think it's a great idea anytime to learn as much as you can of the language. I find that getting around Italy is not very difficult. As far as Europe is concerned, the language wars have been fought and we won. And so if you have a person, you know, from Norway talking to a person from Greece, they talk in my language. Mm-hmm. And if you are struggling a little bit to have some trouble, then look around for anybody under 25. And it's a very good bet that they speak at least passable English.
Very interesting. I wondered about that. If people are concerned about that, would a traveling with a group or traveling, a tour group. What are your thoughts on that?
I think if you need a tour group, it's better than not going at all. My preference is I will only use a tour group if it's to an exotic destination. And while Italy may seem exotic, it is a very predictable, very westernized, very tourist-oriented place. And generally, you don't need to be on a tour. When you're on a tour, they take you to places they want you to see. When you're on your own, you go to places that you want to see. And there's a kind of a big difference there.
Patricia in Milwaukee will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Patricia.
Aloha, Larry, and bueno to your guests. Three or four tips. I've been to Italy on a tour, and the first thing I would suggest is learn a little bit of Italian. You learn a little bit of basic Italian language, and it is so beneficial as an American tourist. Second, find the best limoncello for after your lunch and drink a little bit of limoncello to cleanse your palate. Third, you can buy Murano in Venice. You can also find some nice gold and some leather jackets in Venice. I don't remember the name of the shop that I was at, but there was one individual who said, oh, you're from America. Do you have a nice house? I have a nice house in Italy. Let's change houses. So there's all kinds of cool things going on in Italy, and I would definitely recommend anyone to be an Italian tourist.
Oh, Patricia, thank you so much. Comment there, Glenn.
I have an even better idea. Buy a house over there. You can buy a house for €1. And you're thinking, well, there might be some strings attached to that. But what they're doing, and it's a successful program, is the depopulated villages of Italy are making a legitimate offers, and you can pay €1 for a property, but you have to have a plan in place to fix it up within a year in order for that to be the case. But that is their solution for, you know, the kids having left home and there's nobody left to run the place anymore. Let me add one more thing, too, about if there's a gap in your translation. You should have installed on your phone Google Translate. And the best use of it is when you run into a menu that doesn't have an English translation, and you know you're ordering chicken and you end up with chicken gizzards instead because you don't know what gizzards is in Italian. Google Translate, you just hover it over the menu, and the menu will still be in Italian, but on your screen it'll be in English.
Very good tip as well. And Pat, thanks again for calling. Pat was Pat and I and a whole bunch of other people were on a. We're on a trip once to Hawaii, so she, if she calls, she usually says aloha, which is always, it's always nice to hear her voice. Thomas emailed, he has a friend who wants to propose to his girlfriend during an upcoming trip to Italy. Any suggestions for a good spot if you're going to do that deed and propose?
Oh, wow. I would say... either Lake Como, which I consider the most beautiful place on earth, would be a great choice, and the town of Varena in Lake Como, or any place along the Amalfi Coast. And there's just a wonderful drive, a kind of a cliffside drive. And if you do that, I recommend what we did last time was we hired a driver to take us and show us all the hillside towns. Because if you don't hire a driver, then whichever one of you is driving isn't going to see anything but the road, because it is, you know, very precipitous kind of a road. But you talk about one romantic town after another on the Amalfi Coast. I think you can't go wrong there.
There you go, Thomas. Thanks for calling. Grant emailed us. They're traveling to Italy the first week in April, spending 3 days in Apulia, A-P-U-L-I-A.
Apulia, yeah.
Apulia with Bari as their home base. Can you suggest some not-to-be-missed spots in that part of Italy? Grant will be using public transport while traveling over a weekend. This type of travel on Sundays in particular appears to be very limited in this region, and wonders if you have any suggestions for that as well.
I am not. I love that part of Italy. And Bari, and not too far away is the town of Trani, T-R-A-N-I. I was even more enchanted by Trani. We were there during their midnight run every year in October. So if you're a runner, This is like a 10K or something. It seems like all night runners are going past your hotel.
Pretty cool.
Below you. And it's a very cool thing to do. So Trani is really cool. But the coolest thing on that part of Italy is Matera. This is a city down in the Heel, so it's a little further south of Bari, where you are. But if you can get down to Matera, it's like being in first century Jerusalem. That's the feeling that you get. And if you want to get what it really looks like, if you're a James Bond fan, the last movie was No Time to Die that came out in 2021, and it takes place, the first part of it takes place in Matera. And it'll give you an idea. This has been inhabited since Neolithic times. So a lot of it's built around caves that people lived in. And we ate in a restaurant that was essentially a cave. So it is a very, very unusual place.
Wow. Well, don't miss that one, Grant. Thank you very much for that question. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You're going to add something, Glenn.
Well, somebody mentioned Cinque Terre a few minutes ago. Cinque Terre literally translates to five towns, and it's on the other side of Italy. It's on the west side of Italy, let's say, northwest, and it is a beautiful area. It was kind of discovered by Rick Steves. Who now, I don't want to say he regrets discovering it, but it's been kind of overrun by tourists. And he says, if you're on a cruise ship, please do not come to Cinque Terre, because you're filling up the place during the day and you're spoiling it for everybody. So, but it is a beautiful place. And if you can make it there, you can actually walk between the five towns. But I would recommend the walk between Vernazza and Monterosa. It's only a couple of miles. And we actually tried to do it. When we went there, there had been a landslide, and so we couldn't do it. But we decided to walk as far as we could. And I thought, well, why is a little landslide keeping them from opening this trail? We get out there, and it turns out that the trail is more or less bolted onto the mountainside. And so I can see where you've got no choice of going anywhere except on this platform that is stuck out over the mountain into the abyss. So, but it's still, it's a fantastic, very pretty area.
And that reminds me, hiking, about, you know, hiking and walking, what do you suggest are good places to do that kind of thing?
The best area, reportedly, and I didn't become a real hiker until I retired from teaching, and I hiked across England at Hadrian's Wall. And so it took 7 days to go 84 miles, and at that point I was hooked on hiking. And so even to this day, I've got my hiking boots on. So I'm ready to go anytime. But if you're going to go hiking in Italy, I recommend the Dolomites. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. If you want, you can hike hut to hut, which is kind of a neat way to do it. And I looked up what's really the best trail there. It's called Alta Via 1, and it takes 6 to 10 days to walk it. So look at the Dolomites if you're planning on hiking over there.
Boy, that makes a lot of sense. And of course, it takes 6 days, but there's plenty of stops along along the way.
True that.
For sure. So, best options to fly from Italy to another place.
It is so easy now with European airlines. The cheap airlines are flying anywhere. And EasyJet. I've got a friend of mine who's going to Italy in June, and he's got some extra time afterwards, and he's thinking about going to London. So I looked that up. EasyJet for about $72 has a flight right from Rome to London, and I'll tell you, any other place you want to get to is probably pretty easy. The main places you're going to fly into are going to be Milan or Rome. Now, this last time I flew into Florence and I flew home from Venice, but these are comparatively small airports. Typically, Milan and Rome are going to be the points of access.
Mike in Lake Mills has a comment for us. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to relate our experience going to the island of Sardinia, and more specifically to a small island on the north side of Sardinia called La Maddalena. And I have to tell you that it was wonderful. And one of the things that was a really great surprise was that we were considered a rarity to see Americans. They said that typically, since the NATO base there, naval base was closed, that they rarely see Americans visit there. And it was an absolutely gorgeous island, beautiful beaches, all granite. The boat tours were very pleasant. The water is just incredibly clear. It's like a national seashore, so there's no fishing around there. So there's no stinky fishing boats and things like that, and any flotsam or anything like that. Everything is absolutely spotless.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
It does. I have a sad story about Sardinia, and that is in October I was on a boat, and Sardinia was one of the stops I was looking forward to. And what happened was there was a fire alarm on our boat in the middle of the night, and it turned out to be a control panel that was bad. So anyway, they fixed the control panel. We're in the town of Livorno, which is kind of a forgettable little town. It's a Sunday. So the authorities said, well, we're not going to sign off on that because it's Sunday. You know, well, what do you think? We'll come tomorrow. Anyway, they didn't come the next day. So late in the afternoon, the captain makes a break for it. And all of a sudden, we're about an hour out of Livorno, and there's another announcement. We've been ordered back to the port.
Oh.
And now they punished him by keeping him in port for 2 days before they'd sign off on it. And Sardinia is one of those places that washed out, and we never did get to see it.
Oh, my gosh. Well, those are some of the stories that at the time are terrible, and maybe they're terrible in retrospect, but they're always a good story.
Larry, we were forced to eat our way through the 3 days.
not a bad way to pass the time away for sure. You know, Florence, we really haven't talked much about Florence, don't think. Let's talk about Florence.
No, Florence is not just a spectacular place, but it's in primary location in Italy for all sorts of places. So if you are going to Florence, you got to plan ahead for this. You're going to want to go to the Uffizi Gallery. But I'll tell you, getting tickets to the Uffizi is you pretty much have to contact them on the third night of the full moon after the cock crows. And it's, you know, very specific instructions. And if you don't do that, you don't get tickets. And you got to show up at the appropriate time that your tickets say, too. So when we were there in November, we went there. And I highly recommend saving time for lunch at the Uffizi, because their rooftop cafe overlooks the cathedral and the river and everything else, and it's just a wonderful spot to spend an hour.
And the art and architecture lovers.
Oh,
what are we going to, you know, if you're an art and or architecture lover, you're going to
right.
Love
this
Florence.
This is classical Italy. You want to get down to the river where the Ponte Vecchio is kind of the center of things. It's a covered bridge that, you know, dates to the Middle Ages. And it's one of those places where you can aim your camera in any direction, and you're going to have one of the best shots that you've ever had, that you're going to frame it and put it up over the fireplace, because it's absolutely beautiful. Now,
go ahead. You
can take some side trips from there, too. And Siena is a good place for a side trip. So we met our friends in Italy in November, and they said, well, you know, we can't see you on Friday because we're taking a side trip to Siena. And these are the friends I have who are the veteran travelers. They've been to 80 or 90 countries, and they know what they're doing. They booked a day trip, not a bad idea. And these places go on Viator, V-I-A-T-O-R, and you can book a day trip, which they did. And so they got to Siena, And somehow they had gotten mixed up in the directions of where to meet to go back to Florence. But no problem. They had given them their number. The problem was, this was November, and it was right after the election. They forgot that they had silenced their phone for any calls except for calls that were in their address book. And so the end result was they missed the bus. Now, they're veterans, so it they found the bus, the local bus stop, and next thing you know, they were back in town. But, you know, for veteran travelers like that to end up like that was kind of a humorous thing to me, not so much to them.
Glenn Schmidt, our guest today, travel writer, author of Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel, as we talk with him about travel in Italy, and certainly inviting you again to join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking travel to Italy today with Glenn Schmidt, travel writer, author of Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel. We had an email from Kevin who said he and his wife went to Cinque Terre and they hesitantly tried some anchovies of assorted styles. And found the dish was fantastic, and we enjoyed it multiple times. They had never tasted such wonderful flavors from the fish, fresh that day, that they have never really liked before, anchovies. Can you share any other foods that are definitely worth going out of the way to try and break the stigma we may have with them?
Well, you know, I'll tell you the biggest thing over there, and it's, yeah, it's a cliche, but it's pizza. Naples believe that they invented pizza, and I have no reason to disbelieve that. And so when we were in Naples in October, we had a guide who has become a friend to us now. We've used him enough. He took us to the heart of Naples, to a place where we were surrounded by police officers and bus drivers eating their pizza. And absolutely, it was the best pizza that we've ever had. And we got out of there for about $12 per couple. and so it was just a fantastic thing. So they, Italy takes simple foods, as you found in your last presentation, takes simple foods and takes them to the next level. Pizza's like that.
Oh, how safe is it to bike around Italy? Somebody wants to know.
Yeah. Choose carefully. One of the things about going through Italy is and think about this if you're a driver. They believe that if there's like two lanes going in each direction, there's actually three lanes. And that third lane is for Vespas. And it's between you and the car next to you. And so as Americans, we're continually being surprised by a car on occupying what isn't a lane, but in Italy is a lane. And you feel like you're going to, kill somebody. And so the streets there and the roads are very narrow, and often there is no apron to the roads, and it's a very challenging thing. I'm sure there are places you can go, but choose very carefully where you go because it looks dangerous to me.
Yeah, and Matt had added, by the way, someone else had added, by the way, could you bike to vineyards? And what about vineyards?
I found a lot more of those down south. I didn't visit any vineyards on this trip, but on a previous trip, I remember we hit about three or four of them, and they will make you welcome, and they will make you buy their wine, and they don't have to persuade you very much. So that's a good thing to do. Larry, can we talk for a minute about travel there?
Yeah.
Because the train system is very good in Italy. And last time I was there, I was just in Florence and Venice. So I didn't need a car. We just used a train between the two and then and public transportation or taxis or Ubers. Now, Uber is an interesting thing in Italy, particularly in Rome. And we haven't talked about Rome yet either,
yeah,
which
no.
we should. But Ubers are essentially part of the taxi ranks now. So if you've got an Uber on your phone, you can still order one there, but essentially you're going to get what amounts to a taxi. But it's something you can do. But if you're not going to some of the main areas like Venice or Florence, if you want to see all of Tuscany, you're probably going to have to rent a car. And it's not hard driving, but to me, the best way to see Tuscany is by car, renting a car.
What about insurance, car insurance?
In my book, I've got a whole section on how to deal with insurance, but you want to make sure that you are seriously insured in Italy and maxed out. There are a number of sites that you can go to. But you have to make sure they work in that particular country. For example, Insure My Rental Car is something that some people use, but I've found out that it's not good in some countries, and they're still going to make you buy it. So when I rent a car, I typically rent from a company that I trust, and then I take their recommendations as to the insurance I should get. I'm going to add one more thing here. I would, at this point in time, I would avoid Hertz. They're having a lot of problems with management. They've been sued many times. They've been putting people in prison for stealing their cars. Not in prison, in jail. And it turns out it's their records that are bad. The people aren't stealing their cars. And they've actually lost a major class action lawsuit on this. But I don't know that they've quite... They haven't cleaned up their act enough for me to want to rent from them for now.
Mm. Matt emailed us about the Dolomites. Cortina d'Ampezzo is so picturesque, especially in spring. Gorgeous drive along the mountains with chalet houses to stop at. You can also see the Olympic game settings, and they are hosting the 2026 Winter Games.
No, they mentioned Cortina, and... That's the home, it's Cortona, is the home of Francis Mays. Francis Mays wrote Under the Tuscan Sun.
Oh.
And if you want to fall in love with Italy before you go there, read Under the Tuscan Sun. She approaches the food and the people and the ambience there as no one else does.
And the Winter Olympics coming there in 2026, so there's bound to be some, I'm sure they're probably already working on that.
Right, there's always a lot of action related to Olympics.
Rome, we haven't mentioned Rome yet, so let's talk about Rome, because that's got to be a popular place for a lot of people to go.
I when I first went to Rome, I didn't care for it much. Every time I go there, I like it a little better. And I think it's because I see different parts of it. Definitely see the Colosseum and the Roman Forum and Trevi Fountain and stuff like that. They're definitely worth it. I like it. I'll stay in like the Campo di Fiori neighborhood simply because that's where the markets are. And those are the kind of things I enjoy. But if you're going to Rome this year, and you talk about the Olympics, here's a big deal going on in Rome. It's a jubilee year for the Catholic Church in Rome. And it's a special holy year that began on Christmas Eve and continues until January 6th. The theme is Pilgrims of Hope. So the place is going to be really, really packed with pilgrims this year.
So definitely an interesting place to visit. How much, what do you pack?
One thing before we get there, if you're in Rome, Vatican City is a place you might want to go to. Now, I went to La Crosse Aquinas, so I speak Catholic fluently, and it really is a help to be over there. But think about this, if you've been following what's happening with the Pope, yeah. He's hanging on. But, depending on when you, you might be seeing the white smoke from the Vatican coming up. So seeing the Vatican itself is worth it, too. The Sistine Chapel is absolutely terrific. And if you want to see the I don't know if the Pope is up for it now, probably not, but Wednesday morning from at 9 o'clock, the Pope speaks in St. Peter's Square. And I actually went there one time, and I was totally amazed by the crowd. It looked like the United Nations, you know, people from all parts of the globe in St. Peter's Square listening to the Pope.
Very, very cool. And, Karen in Oshkosh just emailed us back to cars for a minute.
Yeah.
She's assuming that most of the car rentals are stick shift. Is that still true?
I drive a stick, and I ask for a stick usually because, you know, then I feel kind of like James Bond driving around. But if you want an automatic, they're more available than they were, but they still are significantly more expensive than driving a stick. Here's the other advice I'd give you if you're driving a car that bothered me a little bit. The mountain roads didn't bother me, but their thoroughfares, their highways, have tighter turns than we're used to. If you're out on I-94, you hardly notice the turns. Yeah. But in Europe, you're usually going around some monument or, you know, something that, you know, you can't go through it. You can't build a road through it. And so you're going 70 miles an hour, and you're just making turns tighter in closer quarters than we're used to over here.
Hmm. I had a friend who met a lady here, I think in Atlanta, they struck up a conversation, and they said they were going to go to Italy, and she said, I have a B&B. And she gave them the information. They contacted her, went to her B&B, and had a wonderful time. But what the best options for lodging?
It depends how long you're staying. It depends where you're going. The hotel that we had in Venice was absolutely terrific. And it was the kind of three-star hotel that you would expect. The one we were in Florence wasn't a hotel at all. It was more of a something you'd find in Airbnb. And both have their charms, but it just depends what you like. If you're staying for just a short period of time, you probably don't want to mess with that kind of stuff. My opinion is in the three-star hotels in Italy are still very affordable and ubiquitous. So I wouldn't be afraid to, again, go back to your favorite guidebook, whether it's Arthur Frommer, Rick Steves, or Fodor's. Those are my top three. I wouldn't dream of going to Italy without one of those books. And that's the first thing I do is look those up. Because you can find information online, and TripAdvisor is great, and they'll give you really good information about them. But the guidebook authors have been there before you, and they are on your side.
Yeah. What's the coolest spot in the last 30 seconds or so? What's the coolest place in Italy that you have visited?
Well, I'll tell you. I didn't necessarily want to go here, but the catacombs where the Christians buried their dead back in times when, Nero was running Rome and it wasn't cool to be Christian. And it's a place right outside of Rome called San Callisto. It's right on the Appian Way, that famous old road that the Romans built. And Brother Obit is the one who took us down into the catacombs.
On that note, Glenn, thank you so much for being with us. Look forward to your next visit. We'll talk about another country time around.
Great. Thank you very much, Larry.
Glenn Schmidt, travel writer. His book is Travel Lessons, Your Personal Guide to Better Travel. Great to have him with us. Really appreciate his time. And certainly, I appreciate our team. We got a great team. Producers Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod. Technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. Together we'll find for Lottie. Oh, Egan Thaddeus.